summarize where we were at the end of last time. So we want to define for a potential Q and the bounded Lipschitz domain omega, we want to define the Dirichlet-Neumann map lambda sub Q of a function as follows. We solve the Dirichlet problem for the Schrödinger operator and define this to be the normal derivative on the boundary of the corresponding solution. Since we're talking about weak solutions, we should say that U is a weak solution. Means that this is zero. U is in H1. And this is zero for all V in H1 naught. And so we can also define the proper way to define lambda Q as a map from H a half to H minus a half. So you're given a F in H a half. You solve minus Laplace plus QU equals zero U in F. This in the sense defined above. And you take this to be grad V dot grad U plus QUV. V is in H1. So now V no longer vanishes on the boundary. Instead, it's equal to G, which is in H a half. Hello. And so what I call the triple star identity for conductivities last time here becomes lambda Q1 minus lambda Q2 F against G equals Q1 minus Q2 UV, where U solves this Dirichlet problem and V solves this Dirichlet problem. Let's continue to call this the triple star identity. So that essentially comes from subtracting the definition for lambda Q1 and lambda Q2. And so the first thing I'm going to do is some motivation. For the uniqueness proof. Good morning. In dimensions n bigger than or equal to 3. This will give us motivation for the exponentially growing solutions. Good morning. Understand the U of T almost never closes so. For snow, unfortunately. I was praying for snow closure this morning more than you were. So I haven't done anything yet. I'm just, I have sort of rewritten what we had last time for the case of Schrödinger operators. So let's call this 1, 2, and 3. Then we'll go into the rigorous construction in n of exponentially growing solutions for n equals 2. And then we'll start the motivation for both the uniqueness and did you come all the way from Hamilton? No. Motivation for the uniqueness, and here comes something new, as well as the reconstruction method. In 2D. Okay, so what is the uniqueness proof? The uniqueness says lambda Q1 equals lambda Q2. We want to show, does that imply Q1 equals Q2? So if you wish, the injectivity, i.e., is Q goes to lambda Q injective. So if lambda Q1 equals lambda Q2 from star star star, we see this asks if the if Q1 minus Q2 against equals 0 for all H1 solutions. So when I say each one, I mean week of minus Laplace plus Q1 U equals 0 and minus Laplace plus Q2 V solution, sorry. If this is true for all such solutions, does that imply Q1 equals Q2? So loosely speaking, are products of solutions dense? So this is one of the principal insights in this business, is that in fact that's the case, that products of solutions are dense. So if you think of, say, harmonic functions, suppose both Q1 and Q2 are zero. Harmonic functions by themselves are not dense. But products of harmonic functions are. Okay? So in 2D, for instance, harmonic functions means basically either polynomials like this or polynomials like that. Maybe real parts of such things, but products give you all polynomials. So, okay, so how do we prove this? So based on the idea in Calderon, so sketch of proof. And we'll be doing this more carefully later. Fix a C in Rn. Choose zeta in Cn with zeta plus xi squared equals 0 and zeta squared equals 0. We'll have a basic proposition given zeta in Cn with zeta squared equals 0. And zeta sufficiently large. So first I should say, given Q in some space, to be determined. We'll see what that will be when we talk about the appropriate estimates. There is a unique solution U. Okay, so there's a big step in here. We extend Q to be 0 side omega. I'll come back and explain this in a second, but let me just, let's call this unique solution psi of minus Laplace plus cube psi is 0 in Rn with psi behaving like e to the I x zeta as x goes to infinity. Moreover, we'll show psi behaves like e to the I x zeta as zeta goes to infinity. So let's call this star. So what we're going to do, so most of the work goes into constructing such solutions. Once we have such solutions, now substitute we'll prove this proposition later. So we're motivating the uniqueness proof. We're motivating the exponentially growing solutions. Rigorous construction in 2D today, in higher D later. Because as you know, this doesn't work in 2D. Now substitute u equals psi x zeta v or psi 1 for potential 1. V is psi 2 minus zeta minus xi. So we have chosen zeta such that zeta squared is 0. So u is, so according to this proposition, maybe we should call this proposition proof later. So this is the item number 2. The exponentially growing solutions. Hello? So, once we prove this proposition, we'll have a solution U of the first equation, which behaves like e to the ix zeta for large zeta, and the solution v, which behaves like e to the minus ix zeta plus xi. So we substitute these in star. q1 minus q2 psi 1 x zeta psi 2 x minus zeta minus xi. This is going to be q1 minus q2 let's put a well so now let zeta go to infinity. Assume n is bigger than or equal to 3. The reason is, as I explained last time, that once you fix xi in two dimensions, that fixes the size of zeta. So you cannot let zeta go to infinity. In higher dimensions, zeta is free to be as large as you like. So we have e to the I x zeta, e to the minus I x zeta plus xi. So we get that the Fourier transform of q1 minus q2 is 0. Since that's true for every xi, this implies q1 equals q2 in omega. Okay, so is this clear? Any questions? All right. So we made a conceptual jump here. We went from Q living in omega to Q defined in all of Rn, and all of a sudden we're looking for solutions in all of Rn. Now, why are we doing this? So this was one of the insights of Sylvester and Ullmann. We're doing this because we want to find functions which behave like e to the I x zeta for large zeta. So remark, well, there is no large x if you're just in omega. What we really want in this proof, we don't care what happens for large x. What we really care about is what happens for large zeta. It's not clear how to choose. It's not a priori. A posteriori, I will explain that to you. How to choose f sub zeta such that the solution of minus Laplace plus q u is 0 in omega with u is f sub zeta satisfies u behaves like e to the I x zeta for large zeta. So the obvious thing, the naive guess, u is e, just make it e to the I x zeta on the boundary. Solve the Dirichlet problem. What happens for large zeta doesn't work. This does not work. So if you look at this is a here's a simple linear problem that nobody I know can solve. Here's a little Dirichlet problem, perfectly nicely well defined. What is the asymptotic perhaps those of you who will take the asymptotic analysis course will be able to answer this for me. asymptotic behavior of u as zeta goes to infinity. This is an open question in any dimension, and the solution would be helpful. I can make a list of famous people who cannot answer this question. Or, I mean, who worked and tried and couldn't. So let me try to explain what happens. So for large zeta, it's not only Q that enters into these asymptotics, but also the geometry of omega in a subtle way. But this, although we will not need this in this course, it's a very nice, I mean, right? It takes 1 minute to state. Very nice question, which would constitute progress, I think. Very nice progress on other issues, if you can answer that. And so the Sylvester-Ullmann idea was, yes? That is the remark. Right. That's right. That's right. That's why I said a posteriori, I will tell you precisely what f zeta is. After we construct it, and so forth, right? But a priori, if you don't want to live in Rn, you just want to live in omega, it's not clear how to choose this f. So the Sylvester-Ullmann idea was, let's throw the boundary to infinity so that we shouldn't have to worry about these subtle reflections at the boundary. And so we now look for the solution which behaves in x. So that is as if we had put this condition far away. In x, it behaves like this at infinity. It turns out then, it's not trivial, but then you can construct such a solution, and furthermore, it has the required behavior in large zeta. So this is analogous to something that happened in quantum mechanics, where for large energies, you don't see the potential. So you construct these the way you do scattering theory. You want things that look like, quote, a plane wave far away. And then these plane wave solutions don't see the potential for large energy. That's just an analogy. Remember, our energy here is zero. We're very low budget, we're working at zero energy. No great accelerator. Okay. So, to continue the motivation for how we're going to construct these exponentially growing solutions, we let mu is e to the I x minus I x zeta psi. Right, this exponential factor bugs us, so let's just factor it out. So then psi is e to the I x zeta mu. I'm going to derive the the equation for mu. Grad psi is I zeta mu plus grad mu. So Laplacian psi is the divergence of that. So that's I zeta dot grad mu plus Laplace mu plus I zeta dot this. Here we have I zeta times I zeta, that's zero. So we're left with Laplace mu plus 2i zeta dot grad mu. So another way to say this is that the Laplacian conjugated by this exponential is the operator another way to say this. And so we need to solve minus Laplace mu minus 2i zeta dot grad mu plus q mu equals 0 in Rn with mu going to 1 at infinity. And so that the construction of these solutions then corresponds to getting good estimates for this operator. And so we'll have the Green's function gx zeta for minus Laplace minus 2i zeta dot grad. Factored out the growing exponential, now we're playing with tempered functions. So G, a tempered distribution. We've factored out the exponentially growing part. So we can take a Fourier transform, and this becomes xi squared plus 2 zeta dot xi g hat equals 1. So g hat is 1 over xi squared plus 2 zeta dot xi. G is 1 over, so it's the inverse Fourier transform. And if you take, so notation, if we define capital G to be e to the I x zeta times little g, and you trace your way back to this, then minus Laplace capital G is delta. And capital G is e to the I x zeta over 2 pi to the n times this. So let me entertain you with a little bit of history. Well, maybe I should also make a remark before I do the history. Double star also makes sense for any zeta in Cn, but let's not take it real because otherwise we need to discuss the singularities. So it doesn't have to be zeta squared equals zero, in which case minus Laplace plus G equals zeta squared G plus delta. Okay, so the first thing to say is, even if you don't care about inverse problems, what you're learning here is a family of Green's functions for the Laplacian, which have this prescribed exponentially growing behavior. You can also extend it to a family of Green's functions for, say, the Helmholtz operator, if you make zeta squared equals 1 or 7. What is your question? I'll discuss that in a second. Yes, we have singularities, but when zeta is non-real, the real part and the imaginary part are linearly independent, and this turns out to be locally integral. So it's unambiguously defined. When these are, when zeta imaginary goes to zero, it's no longer locally integrable, and then you have to define it in the sense of principal value or whatever. So you can make sense out of the limiting thing. Right. In which case, we're safely away from from real, unless zeta is zero. Comes from right here. If zeta squared is not zero, then you'll get a zeta squared here. So around 1984, I was working with Ablowitz and we were looking for the right way to approach inverse problems in higher D for Schrödinger operators. And for the Schrödinger, or for this, there are too many Green's functions, it's not clear, so we went from the heat equation. And we, by a limiting procedure, got this Green's function. Independently, Beals and Kaufman thought of using this precisely when zeta squared is zero, just because they didn't want bad singularities. And things work nicely, as you will see later on. So Ablowitz went to Russia. There's a whole story behind that. It was around the time when they shot down the Korean, Russians shot down the Korean plane, and Ablowitz had a Navy grant, and so he had to argue with the Navy whether they would let him speak in Russia. The answer, by the way, is you can speak, but you can't say you're supported by the Navy. And so we were quite proud of this, and then Fadeev said, haha, look in my paper from 1966. Where you will find precisely this Green's function. And so I've taken the habit, which Fadeev is very fond of calling this the Fadeev Green's function. And much later, in joint work with Rick Levine, I wanted to have some LP estimates for this Green's function. I guess about 86 or so. And after we proved them, we found out that such estimates had been done in what is now a paper I'm sure you're maybe familiar with, by Koenig, Ruiz, and Soge. So it turns out that this conjugated Laplacian is a natural thing to look at in the context of unique continuation. And so when we go back to higher D, I will try to say something about the Koenig-Ruiz and Soge estimate, and that's essentially the main ingredient in the proof of the proposition that I sort of sketched before. So the proof that you can construct such exponentially growing solutions is based on estimates. So proof of proposition. Will rest on estimates. You know, let's call this G, well, all right, on G zeta. Okay, so I thought I should start in 2D, just because in that case we can sort of get a more concrete understanding of this Green's function, what kind of estimates should we expect, and so forth. And so we'll do that. So we're now up to here. And so I will start the second hour by discussing what happens in 2D. Okay, 2D. So zeta squared equals 0 means zeta 1 squared plus zeta 2 squared is 0. So basically, zeta 1 squared is minus zeta 2 squared. So if zeta 1 is k, where k is some complex number, zeta 2 will be ik or minus ik. And that's very pleasant because instead of working on a variety in CN, we're now in the complex plane. So our parameter is a complex number. And for most purposes, it will suffice to just look at this sheet. So strictly speaking, the variety zeta squared is 0 is made up of two sheets. We'll just look at one. So then e to the I x zeta, x1, x2, dot zeta 1, zeta 2, k I k. So this is e to the I k, x1 plus I x2. So that's e to the I k z. For solutions of minus Laplacian plus Q, psi is 0 in R2. With psi behaving like e to the I kz. Or if it's here, it would be kz bar. And this is as z goes to infinity. A related wonderful thing is that the Laplacian factors. So Laplace e to the I x zeta, e to the minus I x zeta, is Laplace plus 2i k ik dot grad, which is Laplacian plus 2ik dx plus I dx1 plus I dx2. And so recall that the D bar operator, the Cauchy-Riemann operator, defines to be a half dx1 plus I dx2. D will be a half dx1 minus I dx2. And the basic fact, which will be at the heart of the 2D solution, is that dd bar is basically the Laplacian. So coming back to this, I can write it as 4 dd bar, or actually d bar d. And then this is just 2d bar. So this is 4ik d bar. So that the conjugated Laplacian factors as d bar times d plus ik. So we're interested in an inverse for this operator. This is the operator with kernel, the Green's function we wrote down before. So in 2D, that means a quarter d plus ik inverse d bar inverse. And this is the operator with kernel G X, pardon the abuse of notation. So here K is complex. It's going to be E. It's going to be 1 over 2 pi squared E to the I X C over C squared plus, going back to this, zeta is KIK, so it's 2K C1 plus I C2. So we can factor C1 plus IxC2, C1 minus IxC2 plus 2k. Okay, so this is basically the factorization on the Fourier transform side. Representing these operators. Okay, so all this is good fun, but now we want some estimates. So we want some estimates for D bar inverse. Now, of course, when I say D bar inverse, D bar has a huge null space, namely all the holomorphic functions. So to make it invertible, we're going to require, let's say, that things go to zero at infinity, which is going to tie in with the condition at infinity later on. So let's so before we do the lemma, let's do a little calculation. So if D bar U equals F and U goes to zero and Z goes to infinity, I claim that U is 1 over pi F of Z prime over I'm just checking what sign there is here. Not on the two pads I brought, must be on the third that I left there. Yep. Okay, so dz prime r is just the two-dimensional Lebesgue measure. So the claim is that we define this as d bar inverse f. Well, for the moment, we're just doing this. What we're going to have so we want, let's say, 4 d bar d plus ik mu plus q mu equals 0 with mu going to 1. So the way we're going to solve this is mu is going to be 1 minus the inverse of this. Applied to q mu. So if this goes to zero at infinity, mu will go to one. So I'm building up to that integral equation. Thank you for asking. by first trying to construct this operator, I'd like to know what spaces to work in so as to specify what I mean by this and where I'm looking for mu. But this is good to keep in mind for where we're headed. Okay, so we're starting small. We're just starting, suppose we just had D bar here. So my claim is D bar inverse is an operator of convolution by Z. And there are at least two ways of seeing this. One is, so two ways to see this. One is using the Cauchy-Green formulae. And two is using the Fourier transform. So let me quickly remind you of the Cauchy-Green formula. We all remember the Cauchy integral theorem, which says f of z is 1 over 2 pi I integral of f let's say on the boundary and here dz prime, what is it, z prime minus z. So this is the Cauchy integral formula for if f is analytic. But for some reason we don't all learn that there's a more general formula. For the case where f is just a smooth function. And now I don't remember the constant, so I'll put a question mark on the constants. And here comes d bar of f. So different people give this different names. Since it's basically Green's theorem, integration by parts, whatever you want to call it, okay, so in particular when f is analytic you get the Cauchy integral formula. And so let let omega be the disk of radius r. Assume f goes to zero as z goes to infinity. Then, roughly speaking, and you can make this rigorous, get f is 1 over 2 pi I d bar f over z prime minus z d dz prime wedge dz prime bar. So I should have called it U to match up with the okay, if you give me D bar U equals F, I can recapture U by convolving F with 1 over Z. And that's what's claimed up there. Ah, right. Sorry. And let R goes to infinity and above. So that's a quick way to compute the kernel for D bar inverse. But you can do it with no complex analysis at all. You can simply say D bar U equals F, take Fourier transforms, and we get 1/2 I C1 plus I C2. U hat is F hat. So U hat is 2 over I U hat C. U 2 over I F hat C over C1 plus I C2. Oops. So U is convolution. So the inverse Fourier transform is the convolution of the inverse Fourier transform of this, which is F, with the inverse Fourier transform of C1 plus I C2. And this is locally integrable, and in fact you can do this integral by contour integration. How many people want to see that? Okay, so exercise equals dot 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 equals 1 over pi x1 plus I x2. Okay, so either way, we have the D bar inverse defined as the convolution by 1 over z. So the kinds of estimates that we need here are in fact not subtle. So recall Young's inequality for convolutions is that F convolve G LR if F is in LP and G is in LQ, where 1 over R plus 1 is 1 over P plus 1 over Q. So for us, g of x1 I x2 is 1 over x1 plus I x2. And you can say, well, near zero, that's in a certain LP space or LQ space. At infinity, it's in another LQ space. That's the sort of elementary things which you can find in Vekua's book. But more to the point, this is precisely a function which is in weak LP, LQ. So let me remind you what weak LQ is. LQ weak is the set of functions G such that the measure of the set of X where G of X is bigger than lambda is a constant times lambda to the minus Q. And the smallest constant is the, let's call it G Q W for weak norm of G, weak LQ norm of G. And the way to remember this is to start from a good old-fashioned LQ function, and do Chebyshev's inequality. So the integral over all of Rn is bigger than the integral on this subset, and on this subset G is bigger than lambda, so this is the measure of the subset. So this is bigger than lambda to the Q integral of 1 over this subset, which is bigger than or equal to lambda to the Q times the measure of the set of points where G is bigger than lambda. So if G is in LQ, usual LQ, then G is in weak LQ with the measure, the measure of the set where G is bigger than lambda is less than 1 over lambda to the Q times this. Constant. I think you raise this to the Q's power. So the weak norm is less than or equal to the usual norm. And so an example, so a function like 1 over z is, the space is tailor-made for such thingies. Running out of space. So example, one over x1 plus I x2 the measure of x such that this is bigger than lambda is simply the set where this is less than 1 over lambda. And that's just a disk of radius 1 over lambda. So that's pi over lambda squared. So even though this function is not in any LQ, right, because whatever Q works near zero doesn't work at infinity, it is precisely in weak, how did I write it? Maybe we should just write weak here, because later on we'll have weights, and I don't want to confuse the weak with the weights. We'll be done with weak after this hour we won't be talking about this. So it's precisely an L2 weak. So in fact the norm is square root of pi. Okay, and so the good news is there's a generalized Young inequality. Which says that F convolve, it's exactly the same thing. F is still in LP, but G is in LQ weak. (Clears throat) but now it no longer holds in L1. And it's obtained just like Young from interpolation theorems. So whereas Young, you have restoring interpolation, for this one, you use, what's it called, Marcinkiewicz interpolation, which allows for weak spaces at the endpoints. Okay, and so D bar inverse so D bar inverse takes LP, so its convolution by G with G equals 1 over pi x1 plus I x2 hence D bar inverse F LR is less than or equal to the constant is the constant in Young's inequality times the LP norm of F where 1 over R plus 1 is 1 over P plus a half. So instead of R, I'm going to write P tilde. Well, I put, you can throw it in the C. So 1 over P tilde is 1 over P minus a half. And you can check that that requires P to be between 1 and 2. And therefore, P tilde correspondingly will be between 2 and infinity. Okay, so we have our first lemma. For any F in LP, there is a unique U in LP tilde with D bar U equals F. Moreover, U LP tilde is less than a constant times the LP norm of F. So I've shown you the existence of such a U by just constructing it. Uniqueness. So proof, we've shown existence above. is 1 over pi x convolved with 1 over z. Uniqueness says d bar u equals 0 and u in LP tilde implies u is 0. So this is a form of Liouville's theorem. And so in the few minutes that remain in the hour, I will give you my proof of that without any complex analysis. Yes, we're done with this. So if an analytic function is in any LP space, so a little lemma. If u is 0 in the sense of distributions and u is in LQ, then u is 0. Of course, we can't let q equals infinity because that's bounded functions, and that could, you know, that can allow constants. Well, d bar u is 0 means, let's first take u, case 1. Q is between 1 and 2. Then, the Fourier transform of u is a function. And from the assumption c1 plus ix c2 u hat is 0. All right, let's put almost everywhere since u hat is only defined almost everywhere. So this implies u hat is 0 almost everywhere. Done. Case 2, if q is bigger than 2, well, then u hat is not a, it's a tempered distribution, and we don't want to, you could still play with this and say it's supported at 0, and then use the fact that distribution supported at 0 must be delta functions or its derivatives. But I want to keep it elementary. So we let q be the integer part of q. And let v be u to the power q. If u is analytic, u to the power 7 is analytic. So then d bar v is 0. And v to the power is u to the power q. And q over q is bigger than or equal to 1, strictly less than 2. So reduced to case 1. So that's my proof of Liouville's theorem in LP spaces. Okay, so we're going to build on this little lemma to have solutions for the Laplacian in hour 3. So some of you enjoyed this, but let me temper your enjoyment by saying that this is still a trivial estimate in the sense that it does not, right? If you go back, you'll see we put absolute values in when we estimated the weak norm of this. So it does not take into account any sort of subtle cancellations. So this is in a particular case, in fact, of the Hardy-Littlewood-Sobolev inequality. Hardy-Littlewood-Sobolev inequality for fractional integration. So if instead of what we had, we do this, let's call this IF. Right, so clearly D bar inverse F and this is also in weak L2, so the same thing works for IF. And this is basically minus Laplacian to the one half, to the minus a half. Wait. Plus a half. Right? Like D bar, it's the first order. No, minus a half. It's an inverse. So think of D bar as behaving like the square root of the Laplacian, first order operator. The square root of the Laplacian. Silly, because in D bar inverse we had 1 over pi times. Yeah. But I would just want to connect this, in particular, to tell you why this is called fractional integration. So fractional because of the one-half. So if you had Laplacian to the one-half, that would be a fractional derivative. Since you are doing Laplacian to the minus a half, it's a fractional integral. So a fact which I will not prove, and which does take cancellations into account, the operator, is it D bar inverse that I need, or D bar inverse D? D bar D inverse. Bar inwards. which is defined on the Fourier transform side. By d d bar inverse f Fourier transform c is basically c1 minus I c2 over c1 plus I c2, so it's obviously bounded on, since this is bounded, right, is obviously bounded on L2. Since the multiplier C1 minus IXC2, C1 plus IXC2 less than or equal to 1, so that's just Planck's theorem, but you need a little bit of Calderon-Zygmund theory. So in fact, it says it's bounded on LP. That's a much nicer estimate because this does take into account subtle cancellations. So we'll this is often called the Beerling transform. Okay, so lemma two. Part one, for any K in C, and any F in LP, there is a unique U in LP tilde with D plus IKU equals F. Moreover, D plus IK, U LP tilde less than a constant times FLP. This constant does not depend on K. Very good question. I claim this is in fact not what we need. So over here I'll give you a little more motivation for part two of the lemma. So motivation for part two of the lemma. So we're interested in D plus IK inverse of D bar inverse F. Right? That's the conjugated Laplacian we're playing with. So if F is in LP, D bar inverse F is in LP tilde, so part one of the lemma is useless right now. So we can't apply part one of the lemma. What to do? Part two says, if G is in LP tilde, so think of this as G. It's not our Green's function, it's just a little g. And DG or D bar G well maybe I'll say DG is in LP, okay, so at first I was stumped by this. We can't apply the lemma, so what do? Well, so what's special about D bar inverse? It's in LP tilde, but also D bar of it, or D of it, is in LP by the Björling transform property. So I'm going to exploit the fact that DG is in LP. Then, for any K which is in C but not 0, there is a unique solution W in LP tilde of D plus IKW equals G. So that will allow us to define our D plus IK inverse on such things. Furthermore, W is in the Sobolev W1P tilde, so it has one derivative in LP tilde, and it's LP tilde. I have two inequalities now. The LP tilde norm is 1 over K G LP tilde plus DGLP, and the gradient LP tilde right? So this is D plus IK inverse applied to precisely the kinds of functions that we're interested in. So part one is sort of preliminary for part two. What do we do with part one? Well, introduce the notation, which I will keep for a while. E sub k x or z is e to the I kz plus k bar z bar. So as opposed to e to the ikz, which grows exponentially in some places. Here, since we're taking the real part of kz, it's e to the I times a real number, and so it has length 1. And so let's look at what happens when you take d of EKU. So the nice thing about this K bar Z bar is D doesn't see it. D of this is zero, so this is as if this were constant when you're differentiating with respect to Z. So this is IKU plus EK DU. So this is EK D plus IKU. So that allows me to think of D plus IK of D conjugated with EK. So this is the baby version of the conjugated Laplacian, in some sense. So we expect D plus IK inverse to be E minus K D inverse EK. So in fact, if D plus IKU equals F, according to this calculation, then and U is in LP tilde, then D of EKU is EK D plus IKU is EKF. And if F is in LP, with EKF in LP, right? If F is in LP, EKF is in LP, since EK is just bounded by 1. And EKU is in LP tilde. So I have D of something equals something else by lemma 1 prime, which I didn't do for D instead of D bar. Must have, so there's a unique solution, so we must have EKU is D inverse EKF, so U is E minus K D inverse EKF, as expected. And moreover, U in LP tilde is the LP tilde norm of E minus K D bar D inverse EKF. That's just the LP tilde norm of D inverse EKF. And that's less than a constant times the. So here comes lemma 1, then times the LP norm of EKF, which is the LP norm of F. And that's why it's uniform in K. Pardon me? Of D plus IK, yes. With an estimate. Again, I recall before I cover it up, we're interested in this. Which is the same as the inverse of that in 2D. So now part two. So one of my favorite tricks is the resolvent formula. So motivation for part two first. So pardon me for alternating this motivation and proof business. It might make things disorganized, but I don't believe in proof, lemma, proposition. You can read that paper that way. So I'm trying to explain things. So, just formally, we could, for instance, factor why do I want to factor it on? Let's factor the inverse. So this is the identity minus d plus ik, the inverse. So that's how you derive resolvent type formulae. Now here I'm going to factor the inverse. So that's a d. And d minus d cancel, so I get an ik, d plus ik inverse, d inverse. Okay, if you are not used to such things, do it even more formally. How do you subtract fractions? You put a common denominator. Then you have d minus d plus ik. How come I didn't get a minus? Oh, right, there should be a minus. So this you're allowed to do in private, and this is the public way of writing that. Let's put quotation marks on this. It's actually all right because here they commute, and so when things commute, you're allowed to write them this way. Okay. So what? Let me do it. So d plus ik inverse equals down. Okay. So let's multiply by d on the right and solve for d plus ik inverse. So, again, just think of D as the number 7, okay? If I have I minus D over D plus IK, 1 over IK, right? That's D plus IK minus D over D plus IK divided by 1 over IK. D minus D cancels, and I get 1 over D plus IK. So that's a funny way of writing this inverse in that form. What's the advantage? The advantage is that this operator, so I would say this is the new one from part two, and this is the old one from part one. The old one is applied to D of the function in question. And D of the function in question, by assumption, is in LP. Well, this G is a smoother gadget than the F. And I haven't just gained the derivative, but in fact I've gained the 1 over k. So the smoothness gives us decay in k. Let's write this down. Under here, under smoothness corresponds to decay in k. So that's already a weak indication that we're doing some sort of Fourier analysis. But it will be the Fourier variable. All right. So now I'm done with the motivation. Let's write out the proof of part two. So proof of part two. Let W equal 1 over IK G minus D plus IK inverse DG. So I'm inspired, of course, by this formula. Motivation. Well, what is, we can just check, what is D plus IK of W? So IKW is G minus D plus IK inverse DG. DW is 1 over IK DG minus D plus IK inverse DG. So this, by the way, this is the operator from part one. This is the operator E minus K D inverse EK from part one. So DG is in LP, so that makes sense. So then W, then by part one, W is in LP tilde. In fact, the LP tilde norm is less than a constant over K. times the LP tilde norm of G plus according to this, the LP tilde norm of D plus IK inverse is constant times LP norm of G. As claimed. So now all I have to show is that it satisfies the equation. Yeah, but that was formal, and now I want to be a little careful. So this is equal 1 over ik dg minus d. I want to make sure I don't make right inverse, left inverse type of errors. This is e minus k d inverse ek and d of e minus k is minus ik e minus k dv. V plus e minus k dv. So this is 1 over ik dg minus, so it's d of e minus k of that, which is going to be plus ik times e minus k d inverse right, this is my v plus e minus k dv, d the inverse except this is a minus. All right. So this cancels that. Ik cancels, and we're left with e minus k d inverse ek dg. Right. Which is d plus ik inverse dg. So that's dw. Hence, dw plus ikw equals g minus that plus that. You can probably do this faster than I did. But note, this doesn't work if k is 0. Okay, so W satisfies the equation, satisfies the first estimate. For the second estimate, we have DW we saw that dW equals this is not part of that, equals d plus ik inverse dg, hence dW LP tilde is less than a constant dg LP. And from that you get the gradient. And so this estimate is also proved. And I leave the uniqueness as an exercise. By the way, registered students, don't wait till May to hand in your homework, because the purpose of the homework is to keep you reading the notes as we go. All right. Oh, time flies. So maybe I'll stop.